So I thought before launching into the talk, I should start with a moment of silence to remember my MacBook Pro's hard drive, which unfortunately left us as of yesterday morning. It's only due to the generosity of people in this room that this presentation can still take place. There was a lot of last-minute file rescuing happened yesterday, so if the slides seem a little textier than they would usually be, it's because that usual pruning back process didn't have as much time to happen. But in any case, I should mention that this isn't a mechanical failure. The hard drive itself is fine. It was a software problem that caused the corruption that stop the computer from booting. Which allows us to start talking about software development that affects areas of language documentation and revitalization. And in particular, this afternoon, I'd like to consider two points. First, and more broadly, some of the challenges that face software development in these areas, and not just focusing on these as punctual events, but really looking at it throughout the life cycle of these tools, from their initial design and implementation, all the way through to their release and eventual maintenance. And then going into a little more detail, taking a look at the development of one small linguistic software tool, namely Cupid, and taking that as an opportunity to reflect on these kind of tools' relationships to and roles within the larger setting in which linguistic software development ultimately takes place. Now this, as David already said, this isn't necessarily your average topic, so I think it deserves a justification. Why should we talk about linguistic software itself, or software development even, within the context of language documentation or revitalization? And again, I think there's at least two good reasons. First, it's that there's been a formational role played by digital technologies in the development of both language documentation and revitalization. I think this is pretty uncontroversial, and in language revitalization efforts, it's hard to imagine projects that aren't making use of digital technologies, at least in some way, shape, or form. Whether there's a recording component or some sort of archiving going on, even the materials that are brought into classroom often have been developed, at least in part, using digital means. And likewise in language documentation. This has been something that's repeated oftentimes in literature. There's these digital technologies that have really helped language documentation to emerge as a distinct discipline. And relatedly, these technologies are pervasive. There's an increasing presence of digital tools that really shapes our everyday practice in doing language documentation and revitalization. And that, in turn, informs our expectations of what we can be doing and what we should be doing in language revitalization. There's a nice quote from Tony Woodbury, actually, from this 2003 article, where he says the technology, he goes on, more than anything, has really shaped our thinking, or changed our thinking, about the physical possibilities of language documentation. And he goes on to say this revolution in both the magnitude and quantity of linguistic documentation has brought about permanent changes in what people plan and hope for. So in other words, this kind of digital technology is changing our expectations. It's changing our way of thinking about language documentation and revitalization on a practical level. I think that deserves attention in its own right. So even though we've started to see that these digital tools do play a role in both language documentation and revitalization, and they've changed or maybe even heightened our expectations of what we should be able to do with them, that hasn't necessarily resulted in commensurate attention being paid to how these tools actually come about. Right? We recognize that they're important, but we're not necessarily talking about how they're coming to be. But as a discussion in this case, it's primarily been from the perspective of the end user alone. And there are definitely exceptions to that trend that are well worth noting. And those perspectives are valuable. I don't mean to suggest otherwise, but I think it also risks leaving out of focus the whole set of participants, the whole set of circumstances involved in these tools' maturation, their emergence, and how they eventually grow obsolete. That is something I'd refer to here as the larger software ecology. And again, this is a non-standard term, but I'm not the first person to use something like this. Actually, I'm following Jeff Good in taking this sort of ecological metaphor and trying to apply it to this larger set of linguistic participants, the people who are involved, the tools, so the sorts of software that we're using in this case, and how they all interact in this larger digital setting. And I think even though that's fairly broad, it's actually useful to set a large frame around the subject, since it helps us emphasize that no piece of software exists in isolation. That is, every piece of software exists in relation to other software that's out there in terms of the niche that or the functions that it fulfills. And when we don't look beyond that borders of individual tools or standards, we may actually end up missing out on potential reasons why the kinds of models of development that are taking place in language documentation revitalization, even though they're recognizing the central role, may or may not actually be sustainable or even healthy in the long term or the short. So given that there has been more of a focus on the user side of things, I'd like to concentrate here on the developers, the tools and resources, and the digital environment in which this development occurs. So basically we're focusing on these bottom three elements in the diagram on the right. And I'd like to take most of this presentation to explore this development more concretely. So to assume a case study, looking at a small linguistic software tool that I had at hand in developing, namely Cupid. Now, some people in the room may not have heard of Cupid before. That's understandable. It's a very small tool with a very niche purpose. Cupid stands for Customizable Presentation of a Land Document. And what it does, well, I should say, it's a small open source tool that takes a LAN transcript, so something like this, where you have audio or video and you're developing something time-aligned, something where you can jump from text to your audio or video and back and forth, and turns it into some other presentation formats. In this case, the sort of prototype application was delivery over the web. So you've developed this nice multimedia transcript, you've dumped all this time and effort into producing something that's richly annotated. Now, how are you going to present this to other people? This is a problem that's common in the literature. Just to give a quick example of Cupid's output, hopefully this will work. I haven't tested it recently. Here is, if we can actually get out to it, here's a little example. This is a file that I helped annotate. It's Martha Clausen. Some people might have seen this example before. She's telling a story in a language called Plokdeech. Now, this is actually being streamed live from the web from Alberta, from Canada. But you can see what she's talking about, actually highlighting the individual lines in this transcript. Now, this is coming directly out of our LAN output. We spent all this time developing something more archivally oriented. And now we're able to develop this nice sort of multimedia presentation. So for a language learner, you don't have to worry about scrolling along while this is playing. It takes care of that tracking on its own. If you want, you can jump back and forth, and it tracks it in the text. So we can actually go ahead towards the end of the story. She's actually telling about stealing apricots as a kid. It's a fantastic little story. She's a five-year-old girl. Her aunt was drying apricots. She always run off and steal a couple and eat them up. And eventually her aunt gets wise, realizes what's going on, and finally, if we jump towards the end here, she says, well, what does her aunt do? Her aunt comes and grabs her. She says, well, what did you do? She says, well, these apricots, they tasted so nice. So, well, come along, come inside. It's fantastic with the hand actions. She said she sent it to the corner. She had to sit in the corner on her knees. And that was such a fantastic lesson for her as a child. We get to the punchline. That she never stole apricots again. In other words, it helped. Now, this is just one potential application, right? I mean, we can imagine fitting other sort of language data from other languages, other communities into this, and getting these kind of presentations. Now, whether or not we want to put them on the public internet is another question, but we could just as easily burn them onto a DVD or a CD or something that you could put on, say, a workstation on a library computer. All these things are options. And again, we're doing this from our original archival sources. That is, we're putting our time and effort into investing something that's going to last in the long term, and then get out what are probably more transitory, less permanent products using this kind of software. So anyway, that was the goal behind Cupid, is to develop something that gives us that kind of output from archival sources, so we can invest more of our time into developing the permanent and less time on the transitory. Now that doesn't tell us how Cupid came about, and I think that backstory is actually important to the case we're developing here. It really grew out of informal discussions with Andrea Perez, who actually led the LAN workshops before this conference, at Infield in 2008, a training institute at the University of California at Santa Barbara, where we sat down and started comparing our approaches to presenting LAN materials. I mean, this is a common enough task where you've spent the time doing a transcript, and someone else wants a copy. Now, they might not be interested in learning LAN, and that's fair enough, but there should be some way for them to interact with it still. And we were both finding that the current procedure of essentially doing manual presentations, spending the time segmenting your audio or segmenting your video by hand, and then developing some sort of style sheet or transformation that's going to turn your XML into something more pleasant and useful was time-consuming, was frustrating, was definitely error-prone. And it certainly wasn't something you could hand over to colleagues or anyone else you're working with and say, here, like, you can use this too. So we got to talking. Both of us had experiences developing these kind of online presentations, and so we sat down and sketched out what we think, or what we thought at the time, Cupid should be and how it should behave. We were able to draw on existing examples, some of the work that Andrea had done with Danaina Kanaga. The website's linked to here if anyone wants to go back and look at it. But really, this was fairly low tech. This is us sitting down at a kitchen table in the cafeteria at UCSB and really writing on paper mockups of what we thought the interface should look like. This window should have that in it. It should provide these features. It should be as simple as click, 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 boom. Really, the goal of this was to provide a simpler way of accomplishing these really common online presentation tasks. So if that was design, that obviously moves us towards implementation. So we set a goal. We said, well, why don't we try and demo this at the next ICLDC, which would actually be the first time it came out in 2009. So we set the goal of developing a working prototype by then. Now, I don't think I've ever published this screenshot. Maybe it showed up somewhere once. This was sort of the original interface. There was a horrible command line system that I would not have sicked on my worst enemy. Eventually, we moved it over to a graphical system. That was a tremendous investment of time. But the only thing that really made that possible was that we're dealing with open source software. Since we decided that we wouldn't hide what Cupid was doing, but really share that with people who might be able to use bits and pieces of it, we're also able to use bits and pieces of other people's software. We could borrow a bit here, borrow a bit there, and make our workload substantially lighter. Not to get too technical, but you can really see from this sort of architecture of the tool that every last component makes use of some other piece of software. So the user interface is not something we developed alone. We use a toolkit. The basic library that makes up the heart of Qubit, again, uses third-party software. Even the media conversion display, the sort of things that are allowing us to stream that video online, were all things that other people had developed for us. Even the basic programming language that we used, it was all open source. Really, this work would not have been possible if people hadn't shared. And by some small miracle, we actually did have a functional prototype ready for the conference in 2009. And we were able to do a demonstration. There was an online release. Conference participants could go and download the tool and try it out for themselves on their own laptop. It works on Windows and on Macs. And the feedback was pretty much immediate, and it was very encouraging. This was the happiest part of the event. It showed that there were several prominent bugs, and so there was a second release shortly, days after the conference. The web server went down. There were many small disasters, but the fires were eventually put out, and we got something released. But the real point of this is the maintenance started immediately. We had a release, and within 2 days, we had bug reports coming in, and there were, like I said, fires to put out. And that was fantastic. I think, as another linguistic software development, this post-release period, which started almost immediately, led to considerable interaction with users, and that helped us identify some of the limitations of the tool at that point, and prompted us to look at areas of possible future development. So if I could make sort of a pros list at this point, we got extensive feedback and feature requests from the users, and this is extremely encouraging. Anyone who's put the time and effort into developing a tool, it's nice to know that it's actually going to some good use, and that people see directions for it. And obviously, it's nice to get a publication out of it. I mean, the software itself is the sort of thing you could put as a CV item, right? And this is something that's also been reported elsewhere in the literature. I was happy when doing background research for this talk to come across statements in other areas of linguistics that talked about this. Scott 2008 says, at first, like Margaret Thatcher, I too was sure I was right. He had released a piece of software and said, whatever I wanted for Wordsmith, software choice, would be the natural choice. He said, I'd simply not imagine any other alternative. And he goes on to say that eventually started getting feedback from users and seeing that his original conception of what this tool was and what it should do was maybe a little too narrow. And with that feedback, it grew over time, in this case, over the next 12 years. Now, there are obviously difficulties associated with this interaction, too. When people point out that there's a rather critical bug, I think it required to a certain extent to address that as timely as possible. And that's not necessarily compatible with other schedule commitments. If you're working on a job or you're doing some form of other study that doesn't involve this software, you have to make time available for this. And that can be difficult. And likewise, the correspondence itself, while certainly rewarding, also represents an investment of time. And this is something, again, that was reported in the literature. Scott goes on to say, this aspect of unpredictability came with my increasing realization that, again, like Margaret Thatcher, I was very often wrong. I like the way he puts it. I felt the same way. I think if we sort of zoom out from Qubit for a second, start looking at the larger environment, once we're in this post-release period, things started to change. Not only the software itself and the requests that people were making, but there were also a growing number of updated and recently released tools for also presenting documentary language materials online. One of the more prominent projects is EOPAS, this is coming out of the University of Melbourne, Nick Tieberg's work. And this is under active development. It's an open source tool. It again presents things online using this new and fairly shiny HTML5 standard, and it's a fantastic tool. Again, this wasn't something that was under active development when Qubit was coming out, but it has emerged since and definitely deserves consideration. Likewise, there is a tool being developed at MPI, Annex. This was being redeveloped. It was actually released at the same conference as Qubit was. That was a fantastic talk to go to and see that a lot of this work was being duplicated in the sense of re-implemented in very different ways. It's a Flash-based tool, and again, it's something accessible online. I'd encourage people to go take a look at it. Now, even if there wasn't direct competition between these tools, I think seeing these sort of things released forces us to reevaluate what the role of a tool like Qubit actually should be, given the presence of other systems. I mean, what things should Qubit be useful for in the end? And not just that. If we turn our attention even slightly more broadly, we also have to look at changes in the larger digital environment and as much as they affect language documentation or revitalization. So since the time of release, we've seen some pretty huge changes. I know this is a lot of technical buzzwords. I mean, essentially, the hardware has changed substantially. I mean, at the time of release in 2009, there was no such thing as iPads. There were no Android cell phones walking around. All that technology is very new, and that's only within the last 2 years. We've seen operating systems change. We've seen the web change substantially in how video is being delivered these days. This is all very, very new technology, but it's really changing the game. Maybe more on the back end, even the development tools that we're using to make the software itself have changed substantially. and the tools that people are using in documentation. So it's not that Elan is the only game in town. Elan itself has changed substantially. But there's also tools like Exmeralda and others as well, alongside EOPass and Annex for displaying these kind of records. If we go back to that architecture diagram, if this is what we were using in the original release, you'd see that every last piece of software that Cupid relies on has changed one, if not two, versions since the initial date of release. I mean, this can break the software any number of times over. But this is something that maybe doesn't shine through when people are downloading a piece of software. So the question becomes, should we maintain it or should we not? Given these larger changes in the software environment and given the fact that they're not uncommon, it should make us think, should we actually bother maintaining the software? And if so, for what purposes? Now, I should say, I don't think there's anything intrinsically harmful in software growing obsolete and being replaced. I think that's a simple fact of nature, the way this stuff works. And indeed, experimental software can actually serve a valuable role, I think, in shifting expectations of what we think is possible and still make room for those functions to be filled by other mature tools or by other agencies. I think what's maybe more problematic is where the rate of obsolescence, the rate at which software is sort of dying off, outstrips the rate of its replacement. So when we see these tools being released and published, but then abandoned, essentially, leaving people with very few options for accomplishing these functions that you've now whetted their palates for. And that ultimately contributes to what I think would be a rather unhealthy ecology. I think part of the issue here is that it's fairly clear that the release of software is in few ways comparable to traditional publication. Giving respect to the resolutions of other professional associations, like the LSA, whose recent resolution on cyber infrastructure officially recognizes the importance of creating computational tools and supporting analysis for collaboration in the field. Even with statements like that, we still see that the continued support and development of this kind of software over years really has few correlates to publishing a journal article, which is really a one-time release, and you're not expected to maintain it over the next number of years. Really, if anything, it's only that initial software release that's considered publication. At best, maintenance is considered academic service, but I've never really seen that show up in a person's CV. So the question then becomes, what can be done? I've decided to frame this in terms of four recommendations or reflections. Again, they're fairly broad statements, but I hope it helps. It's a take-home message. The first one is that I think there's arguably a place for individual contributions to software development and language documentation revitalization, even with these challenges of maintenance. Now, my experience in helping develop and maintain linguistic software in this sort of ever-changing digital setting definitely says that this is not an easy task, but it doesn't lessen the potential for individuals to contribute substantially to what we're actually doing on a day-to-day basis with documentation revitalization. Now, that said, I think we should recognize that software development extends beyond the release period. It's not like a traditional publication, but it goes on into maintenance, and that's something that doesn't have a parallel in traditional publication. This is part of the difficulty, right? That we have this long-term time investment that comes with release, and that maintenance effort really is rarely formally acknowledged. I think maybe as a step forward, we could start by adopting practices from other branches of linguistics, and this is a rather minor step. But in some areas, it's very common to cite linguistic software as references. And this is one way of acknowledging the effort that's been invested. I mean, it feels a bit like an academic tip jar, basically. But the idea is, in quantitative linguistic research, for instance, it's not uncommon for people to cite, say, which versions of statistical software packages they're using. And not just cite them in sort of a blanket form, but actually say, this was the version number. And then if you go back and trace the publication trail, you can see this software was being actively developed. It's another way of recognizing that it's a contribution to the field in general. Now, that's only one suggestion. Now, there's one last point that goes a little bit further off, but I think it's still important to make. In light of our growing reliance on multimedia in doing language documentation and revitalization, I think it's important that we be mindful of the effects that software patents and other intellectual property instruments at the international level may actually have on our efforts. This is something that I've been running into more and more often with developing Cupid, since it deals with multimedia data. More and more users are expecting it to be able to generate things like MP3 files, or MPEG-2 video to be putting on DVDs, or this new H.264, which is what sites like YouTube are using for their high-definition video on the web. These are all patent-encumbered formats. That is, I can't go off and grab a free piece of software to do this for us anymore. I would have to pay a license for anyone to use Cupid. Now, this is a huge disincentive for developers, and it's also a huge problem for things like language archives that are using these formats for delivering materials over the web. If in another 5 years a major archive has to start paying royalties on every video that they have in there, this is a huge burden to be faced by the field. And not only discourage support in smaller software, but support across the discipline. So if I can conclude, I think that we'd recognize that language documentation and revitalization practice is increasingly informed by and challenged by the availability of these digital technologies. I think we definitely do well to heed the warning that Lise Dobrin and her colleagues offer of blindly focusing on tools and standards without looking at their relation to larger goals which underlie their application. That is, it's not technology for technology's sake. But I think that I also contend that reflecting on the development of tools like Qubit and the roles they play within documentation and revitalization might give us a healthy perspective on these larger issues, help us to see interrelationships that we might otherwise have missed, and ultimately also give us a sense of the reciprocity which exists between developing software and the continued formation of these disciplines. Thank you.